It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. We're going to talk about the week's security news. There's a big, big Windows update today. He's got the details. And then later, we'll look at the Zigbee protocol and potential security flaws that make it probably a pretty bad choice for home security monitoring. Steve will have the details next at Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 559, recorded Tuesday, May 10th, 2016. Dumb Smart Things. Security Now is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/securitynow. And by Braintree, mobile app development can be complex, but integrating your payments no longer has to be. With Braintree, your business can accept nearly every type of payment from any device with just one integration. Learn more at braintreepayments.com/securitynow. And by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/securitynow and use a promo code SN30. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your security and privacy online with this guy right here, our explainer in chief, Mr. Stephen Gibson.
For those of you who missed the pre-show, my eyes are watering.
It was kind of a silly pre-show. We may duplicate it, however, as we get into the full content. This is going to be a good show today.
We have a lot to do. This is our dumb smart things episode, where we're going to take a look at some research that various people have done into the operation and architecture and, frankly, the profound failings of the number one most popular home automation Internet of Things system, which Samsung bought from its creator back in 2014 and just sort of added to their Samsung collection of stuff. It is by far, in terms of number of apps and number of devices, currently the leader, although there are a bunch of other companies, one huge consortium, the All Join, J-O-Y-N. That's like the who's who. It's everybody except Samsung is a member of that. So it'll be interesting to see how this evolves over time. But we're going to end up talking about that. But we've got a Mega Patch Tuesday. We've got, thank God, closing the chapter on Dr. Craig Wright. Lenovo, Microsoft, Qualcomm, all in their separate doghouses. A fun little piece of curl bashing following up on the problem of piping the output of curl into bash that we've been talking about for the last couple of weeks. A strange event in the world of terrorist math, an expensive but possibly useful gizmo that I ran across on Gizmodo, a bunch of miscellaneous stuff. The Temperfect mug actually exists. I received it. Actually, I think it was the afternoon of last week's podcast.
Oh,
so I've had a chance to play with it and can review it.
Okay.
I have a significant breakthrough in the healthy sleep formula. You, my sister, and my best buddy are all receiving bottles of one ingredient which is changed, which dramatically improves its strength and will allow – I mean, I'm still recalibrating things, in fact. It's like this is – it's a big
– wow. I get little pill bottles in the mail from Steve. I pick up the package and it's rattle, rattle, rattle. I go, oh, new ingredient.
No excuse for not trying it.
Oh, no, I love it. Keep them coming. Thank you.
We have a little follow-up on last week's hit, the sequence puzzle game.
Ooh.
The new companion app for the Zio is released and available. A few more tidbits and then smart things. So tons of stuff to talk about this week.
Well, I tell you what, let's take a little break because we also have tons of fabulous advertisers.
They keep everything, keep the wheels
keep
rolling.
Keep the wheels rolling. And this is a new one. I'm really thrilled to have them because this is an advertiser that's going to take us into the 21st century if you're not already there. Have you ever, if you've ever bought a house, I think, Steve, you've been in your condo for some time.
Since 1984. That's the George Orwell year. That's when I purchased my home, and they're going to take me out heels first on a gurney.
Then this ad is not going to be of any interest to you whatsoever. No. Well, I guess if you ever run into refinance, you could do this.
I paid that off a long time. I don't have to refinance.
Yeah, you could take a mortgage out then if you needed cash to do something fun and crazy. But the point is, if you've ever bought a house, you in 1984, it was really pathetic, but we bought just a couple of years ago. They still want faxes, paper documents. You go in and you sign 100 documents. Crazy. And so I'm real pleased to welcome Quicken Loans and Rocket Mortgage to our show today because they do it all online, as it ought to be. Rocket Mortgage brings that mortgage approval process into the 21st century. It's fast, it's powerful, it's completely online. They've taken all the complicated, time-consuming parts of applying for a mortgage out of the equation. You can even do it on your phone if you want, or your tablet. And it's because it's online, it's also got great software. It tells you, you could select your term and see how much of a home you can afford. It makes it easy to share the paperwork you need to share with them, like your bank statements and pay stubs with just a click of the mouse. You'll get approved in minutes for a custom mortgage solution tailored to your financial situation. Number one in client satisfaction in the U.S. for 5 years running, according to J.D. Power. They are really great, and you're going to love them. You can do it all on your phone or tablet, all online. You can manage it from the convenience of your couch. So if it's time to refi or time to buy a new home, check out Rocket Mortgage today. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Go to quickenloans.com/security now for more. Buy a home, refinance a home, and do it all online with Rocket Mortgage. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030. Go to quickenloans.com/security now. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support. Nice to have sponsors that make this show possible.
Yeah, and I think a lot of our listeners are at an age where, you know, they're looking to maybe move from apartment life into a home, given their, you know.
Well, they're lucky because I tell you, we bought this house, Lisa and I bought the house. We were on a cruise the loan thing took so long. We didn't expect to be on a cruise. We thought we'd wrap it up.
I remember that it was like still up in the air as you guys were leaving.
And then we're doing all this stuff from the cruise ship. We actually had to get off the boat to send. I mean, it was nuts. So this, I wish they'd had this next time. Rocket Loans.
Well, so we are on May 10th, the second Tuesday of May.
Oh, there's a big one, I think, right?
I made this deliberately redundant because it's just sort of a joke at this point. This is the Windows Patch Tuesday bonanza. And so as I was putting this together, I thought, oh, this is just a crack up because we have a critical remote code execution flaw in Internet Explorer, where Microsoft says this security update resolves vulnerabilities in Internet Explorer. The most severe of the vulnerabilities could allow remote code execution if a user views a specially crafted web page. Critical remote code execution of Microsoft Edge. This security update resolves vulnerabilities in Microsoft Edge. The most severe of the vulnerabilities could allow remote code execution if a user views a specially crafted web page. Critical remote code execution vulnerability JScript and VBScript. This security update resolves vulnerabilities in JScript and VBScript, scripting engines in Microsoft Windows. The vulnerabilities could allow remote code execution if a user visits a specially crafted website. critical remote code execution of Microsoft Office. This security update resolves vulnerabilities in Microsoft Office. The vulnerabilities could allow remote code execution if a user opens a specially crafted Microsoft Office file. Critical remote code execution in some generic Microsoft graphics component. This security update resolves vulnerabilities in Microsoft Windows. The most severe of the vulnerabilities could allow remote code execution if a user opens a specially crafted document or visits a specially crafted website. And it goes on, including same thing for Windows Journal, Windows Shell. And then we have somewhat toned down problems in IIS, Windows Media Center, Windows Kernel, Microsoft Remote Procedure Call, that's, you know, RPC, Kernel Mode Drivers, Adobe Flash Player, .NET Framework, Virtual Secure Mode, and Volume Manager. So, update Windows. I did that on my various Windows 7 machines, and boy, I've been seeing reports about Windows Update being sluggish. And I don't know what's going on. Some people have suggested maybe they're prioritizing Windows 10 updates over the down version updates, specifically Windows 7. But I mean, it's not snappy anymore. That's for sure. I don't. It's like I don't know what's going on. But I had 16 patches on both of two different Windows 7 machines and, you know, some optionals. They keep trying to give me Silverlight. And it's like, no, I'm never going to want Silverlight. Oh, yeah.
I'm telling you, Steve, sooner or later, you're going to go to Linux or BSD.
I don't doubt it.
OpenBSD probably be the right choice for you. But yeah, I just put Linux on a Chromebook Pixel, and it's gotten so easy. I thought this was going to be quite challenging. It's a snap. And this is UEFI and secure boot and everything. And it just, you know, it's you can do it. You have to turn off secure boot, but it's so easy now.
Oh, and we'll be talking about that in a few minutes. Mm-hmm. Because there was a glitch in a bizarre.
I don't want to use Windows anymore. I really don't.
Yeah, I know. You really feel like Microsoft is now fighting their users. Every week now there are problems, and we've got some more that we'll talk about in a second. But I did want to close this chapter on the good doctor, Craig Wright. Everyone will remember that a week ago, just before the podcast, I was just shaking my head, and I tweeted, I sure hope this clown is not Satoshi. Get a load of this latest spew of nonsense. And then I shared last week's spew. So what he then posted, just, you know, you just have to shake your head. It's like, okay, you know, thank goodness.
This is a classic con man.
It is.
Right?
So for people who don't know, just listen to this. It's short and it is just screwball. So it starts out, this is all you get when you go to Dr. Craig Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, it's, you know, D-R, Craig, C-R-A-I-G, W-R-I-G-H-T.net. That's all that's there. I'm sorry, it starts. I believed I could do this. Now, okay, so just for a little backstory, if anyone has skipped any episodes of the podcast or has been under a rock somewhere, that, you know, he was going to give us proof and spoofed, apparently, proof to Gavin, who he knows and cares about for like reasons that are beyond comprehension still, several weeks ago. So now here's the final chapter. I'm sorry. I believed I could do this. I believed that I could put the years of anonymity and hiding behind me. But as the events of this week unfolded, and I prepared to publish the proof of access to the earliest keys, I broke. I do not.
Oh, that's what happened.
He broke. I do not have the courage. I cannot. When the rumors began, my qualifications and character were attacked. When those allegations were proven false, new allegations have begun. I know now that I am not strong enough for this. Okay, well, let me finish. I know that this weakness will cause great damage to those that have supported me, and particularly to John Matonis and Gavin Andreessen. I can only hope that their honor and credibility is not irreparably tainted by my actions. They were not deceived, but I know that the world will never believe that now. I can only say I'm sorry and goodbye.
So that's what a con man does when he gets caught, basically.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Some bizarre Looney Tune spin.
Yeah.
You know, it. He painted himself into a corner.
Yep.
And just, you know, came up with another bizarro spin. Anyway, the guy is, you know,
bye-bye.
We're done with him.
Bye-bye.
So
long. See you later.
Yeah. Hmm. Okay. Okay. Now get this. Asus motherboards for a long time have enabled Windows Secure Boot or just generic, you know, UEFI Secure Boot by default. Secure Boot support was introduced with Vista, so it's always been built into Vista and successor OSs from Microsoft, thus Windows 7. Consequently, when Windows 7 systems have been installed on Asus motherboards, which had Secure Boot enabled, those Windows 7 OSs were configured by the setup system with Secure Boot, which the OS supported by default. Then, for reasons like a week and a half ago, for reasons no one that is still not explained, Microsoft reclassified a previously optional Windows update, which is KB313-3977. They reclassified it from optional to recommended. What that, of course, did was install itself on Windows 7 machines. What does 313-3977 do? It removes from Windows 7 its support for Secure Boot because it's no longer supported, in quotes. So everybody who had Windows 7 installed on Asus motherboards last week, when they rebooted their systems after this recommended update had installed itself and removed Secure Boot, was greeted with a big red warning from the BIOS with the title Secure Boot Violation. The system found unauthorized changes on the firmware, operating system, or UEFI drivers. Press OK to run the next boot device, meaning give up on booting your hard drive, because, of course, you can't, or enter directly to BIOS setup if there are no other boot devices installed. And then it says go to BIOS setup, advanced boot, and change the current boot device into other secured boot devices. Anyway,
wow.
This is just...
I mean, that's what we have. Don't you have an Asus motherboard, too?
My new one was
Gigabyte. You bought Gigabyte.
Gigabyte, yeah.
We bought Asus, so.
Yeah.
I guess I can't do Windows Update. Oh, my God.
Well, so what's crazy is, like, Microsoft seems to be doing things that are hard to explain.
Yeah.
Of course, the conspiracy theorists say, oh, here's yet one more thing Microsoft's doing to try to move you from Windows 7 up to Windows 10. Is like, make Windows 7 no longer boot on your Asus motherboard.
Jeez Louise.
Yeah. So the problem was, there was no clear connection between the, you know, just doing Windows Update, which doesn't normally or isn't supposed to render your systems unbootable, and then this big red BIOS warning saying secure boot violation. How would you put those things together? And it's funny because as I was putting these notes together, I was reminded of my discovery of that very first spyware, that from that Oriate company.
Right.
That's where I created Opt-Out. And what happened back then was that freeware was surreptitiously installing this Oriate spyware, which was designed to be a kind of a central server of ads for that freeware and any other Oriate enabled freeware. But because it was surreptitiously installed, one of the problems was the Oriate freeware was somehow it hooked into IE, but it broke IE for many people. So they install the freeware and, you know, use it to check their shoe size or whatever the heck it was doing. And then they go to use IE, which is now broken. And so they think, oh, that's odd. Well, first of all, there isn't a connection between the two events. It's obvious. But maybe they uninstall the thing that they installed, thinking that it might have some connection, except that the instructions were, because many different pieces of freeware might be using this central ad server, which you had unknowingly just added to your system, the explicit instructions to developers who included this Oriate stuff was, don't remove it, because other software may still be in the system which uses it. So you would remove that bad stuff you had inadvertently downloaded. That is, you would uninstall the freeware. It would leave the Oriate stuff behind, still screwing up your system. And we only found out about this when I created Opt-Out to find it and remove it. And then people said, oh, my God, my browser works again. And I was thinking, what? How does Opt-Out fix your browser? And so it was by reverse engineering that all the whole tale was finally uncovered. But no, so similarly here is, you're just installing Windows updates and suddenly you're getting a secure boot violation, which just seems crazy. Anyway, so Asus has responded. They've got a patch for the BIOS. Maybe users, if they figure it out, can disable secure boot and tell the BIOS, okay, calm down. We, for whatever reason, we no longer have a secure boot capable OS because Microsoft just decided to take that away from Windows 7. So, I'm a Windows developer, Leo. You know, Never 10, it was important for me to be able to crank out Never 10 quickly. We're at something like 335,000 downloads and 5,000 a day. And so it's been I get all this great feedback from people. So I'm glad I'm able to respond. And Windows still is the majority OS in the world. So it makes sense for me to be here, but boy, I mean, Microsoft is just becoming hostile to their users, and I'm with you that it just does not seem like the place I want to be.
It's a mistake. I mean, it's not. I can't be. It's not an intentional. I can't buy with that. It would be intentional.
And it just, you're right. I you have to imagine that somebody at Redmond is in trouble for yeah. not testing this or not considering the consequences. Of retroactively revoking secure boot capability on an OS that has it.
Right.
It's like, what? Yeah. Why?
Odd.
You know, and based on the protocol of secure boot, perhaps they have to do this. But this is, unfortunately, this is something that should have been better thought through.
Is it possible that somebody in the chat room is saying ASUS implemented their own secure boot? Is it possible ASUS did something non-standard and that's why they're, I mean, obviously they're different than anybody else.
Good question. All I encountered in digging into this was that they enable secure boot by default. It may well be that other motherboards.
No, everybody does.
For example, my Gigabyte motherboard supports it, but it's disabled.
Oh, really? Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Well,
so I think
if you build your own, that makes sense because you could then put Linux on it. But if you buy a Windows machine, secure boot is always on by default.
Right. In fact, that was a requirement up until 10. Up until 10, it had to be on by default, but you had to be able to disable it.
Right.
They've softened that a little bit where it's now sort of unspecified. So far, all the systems we've seen, you are able to turn it off. And, of course, the industry is sort of in a quandary at the moment. The alternative OSs need to either know that that systems can have it disabled or be able to support it themselves.
Yeah.
So it's not quite sure where we're going to go. But I think the future is secure boot, that because of problems with rootkits and just trying to tighten security up. To me, this all feels a little bit backwards, though. Look at the list of fixes that we just had today in Windows in terms of, you know, anyone basically touch the internet and you could have malicious code run on your system. Okay, and we're worried about, you know, something affecting the boot. I mean, yes, that's a problem. We should fix that too. But boy, look at the inconvenience that brings to the rest of the ecosystem. You know, no inconvenience to Microsoft. They're able just to say, oh, you know, we're going to have secure boot and we're going to make everybody else do it too.
Right. Well, I remember a lot of Linux users were upset about that because, again, the conspiracy theory was, oh, well, Microsoft doesn't want you to put Linux on your Windows machine. And you do, in fact, have to disable it to use Linux. But you can disable it. So it's not the end of the world, right?
So Lenovo, back in the doghouse, the so-called Lenovo Solutions Center has both a user land or user mode app and a kernel mode back-end server thing. And it turns out that they didn't code it correctly. There is an arbitrary code execution vulnerability. Which allows either a remote attacker or a local user to execute arbitrary code with full system privileges. So once again, a problem with Lenovo. They've scurried around and fixed it. So if you do have Lenovo Solutions Center installed, you may want to ask it for a solution to itself. and have it supply.
That's a little recursive. Solve yourself.
Meanwhile, Qualcomm, it turns out, 5 years ago, back in 2011, they provided some updates to the core Android system, adding a bunch of network features, including tethering capabilities. That required that they update the netd daemon in Android. And it has just come to light that there are some serious problems with that. Now, the good news is not remote code execution, so not as bad as the stage fright problems where just receiving an MMS message can take over your machine. But this is a local privilege elevation flaw, which does allow apps to get up to mischief that they shouldn't be able to. They're able to obtain access to the user's private data, including SMS and call history, to change system settings, disable the lock screen, and more. Now, this has already been patched in the Mayday Android security patch that we talked about last week. So it's been fixed. The concern, though, is that because this is old, this is back in 2011, that it's most worrisome on devices running Android 4.3 Jelly Bean and previous, which are unlikely to ever get patched. So I just sort of wanted to give our listeners a heads up that, I mean, it's not this is a problem that's been fixed in newer Android versions. It isn't known to be exploited, but over time, if you're running older Android, this may not get fixed. I mean, it's probably not going to get fixed, and so it'll be a known vulnerability that some mischievous developers could consider leveraging in order to get access, basically break out of the app sandbox and get access to the OS level features. And in a sort of a side note, both the FCC and the FTC are beginning to wake up to the whole question of mobile security and the obligation of carriers and vendors to patch this stuff. They're asking Apple, Google, and others for clarification of their policies for the factors that they consider in deciding whether to patch vulnerabilities on a particular mobile device. So that's good. As we've been saying on the podcast now for quite some while, you know, these are computers in our pockets. And we now have a long history of understanding that consumer devices need to be patched. First, it's desktop computers. Then it's our mobile devices. And of course, now we recognize that embedded devices like this whole IoT, the Internet of Things world, are going to be needing the same kind of ongoing patch maintenance. There just is, I mean, all of our history and experience says that all of these systems are going to have weaknesses and flaws that need to get fixed. There was also, remember I mentioned last week that the infamous 303.5583 update, I saw that sort of like came back last week. And that's the one that's the Get Windows 10, the GWX update. And there was some anecdotal report after I, you know, like the day after I mentioned that the GWX icon had reappeared and that people were being offered Windows 10 again. Now, the good news is not a single user of Never 10 reported that. I did see one person who said he was going to be reinstalling the big GWX utility thing. I can't remember the name of it.
Control panel.
Oh, the Windows control panel. Yeah. GWX control panel.
Right.
Then in a follow-up of some of the – it was Windows IT Pro that initially reported it on – I think it was on May 5th. Then on the 6th, they updated their story saying that this issue has only been – or may only be responsible – I'm sorry. This issue has only – okay, the English. I did copy it right from the story. This issue has only be reproducible, they wrote, So whatever they
meant. You know, I've noticed lately, blogs no longer have anybody copy-checking or proofreading. Even big blogs, frequent typos. You can see where, obviously the guy wrote bin and then accidentally deleted the EN or something like that. But that, you would catch that immediately if you looked at your copy before you filed it.
Yeah.
The standards have just collapsed for this stuff.
It's funny you mentioned that because there, I was also quoting in the next story the top of a blog post, and it was just full of spelling errors.
And I thought, well-known, like The Verge and stuff. I mean, it's kind of I guess they have to file so fast, so many stories. I mean, they really have to do many, many stories a day that they don't have time to check it.
Well, and
which makes you wonder about the facts.
It's also part of the culture now, isn't
right.
it? It's
yep.
this, oh my goodness, we have to be first out with this. I mean, I will say, on the flip side, I was stunned but pleased by the rate at which Never 10 was like found, and it was like one site finds it, and they're all, of course, looking at each other's Twitter
feeds.
Well,
you can manipulate this exactly because there's such a huge need for content. If they're factories, that they will totally do that. Everybody will pick up everybody else's story, and it just goes. Everything's a wildfire now, or nothing.
Yeah.
you miss that day. It's over.
Yeah.
What's sad is that we can be manipulated, and that's why we have the candidate for president that we have. It's like it's so easy to manipulate that technique as well. And then,
so whatever they meant, they said this issue has only been reproducible in a few reported instances and does not seem to be widespread. If you're experiencing this problem, let us know so we can help determine if it's and there shouldn't be apostrophe there. Anyway, if it's environment or configuration specific. So for what it's worth, this something happened and it doesn't look like – I mean, I immediately was worried when I saw this. It's like I was just so sure that Microsoft would never think of violating their own group policy enforcement to prevent this, which, of course, is what Never 10 uses, is the fully normal, sanctioned, Microsoft-blessed way of
that should do it.
And so I was thinking, oh my Lord, you know, is like Never 10 going to be broken? And it's like, no, it's not clear what it was. What I think must have happened is early on, people, there were other wacky ways of semi-blocking this. And so those people who adopted earlier previous solutions, like maybe they installed the GWX control panel, then removed it, thinking it was no longer necessary, or who knows. And you know, and it did other things than what Never 10 does. But the good news is, we all appear to be fine. And I guess is it the presumption, Leo, that in July when
July 29th.
When the deadline, the deadline
for free is over
by now, or you're going to have to pay $129.
Yeah. Yep, that's July 29th.
Further abused.
So presumably this will all go away then.
Oh, yes, nice.
Oh.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
By the way, important point. Probably everybody should do this. Turn off recommended updates. It is on by default in Windows 10 anyway. Just do critical updates. That's the ones you have to do. Recommended updates are the ones that bring along all of these problems, including the ASUS motherboard problem. Just don't do the recommended updates.
Right. Right.
Yep.
So we've talked for a couple of weeks now, starting with the it was the – I'm trying to think of the name of it. The Raspberry
I'm usually
Pi.
Very good at guessing your –
intent. VPN.
I don't know where you're going with this. That script.
Yeah. The script. But there was a fun name for it. And I'm blanking on it now.
I don't remember either.
The chat room will figure it out. Anyway, the idea was, what was fun was that it was that you could plug a Raspberry Pi into your router, bring up its terminal window, and give it and pipe the output of curl into bash. Curl is you know, CURL is simply retrieves from a URL something on the internet and spews it out. Well, when you pipe that into bash, the spew goes into the bash shell. So bash interprets those lines as commands. And basically, so it's an automated, it's a cool way, but dangerous, as we talked about last week, of like basically turning your little Raspberry Pi over to a server on the internet to, in this case, install the OpenVPN. Okay, I think this will be the final comment on that, but I got a kick out of this. Phil, whose last name I couldn't find, he has a blog at idontplaydarts.com.
Good name.
And so he said, installing software by piping from curl to bash is obviously a bad idea. And a knowledgeable user will most likely check the content first, which we talked about last week. So, wouldn't it be great if a malicious payload would only render when piped to bash? So we're escalating this as an attack vector. He said a few people have tried this before by checking for the curl user agent, which is by no means fail-safe. Now, meaning that remember that whenever you ask a server for something by URL, what part of the query, the so-called metadata, the query headers, there's a user agent. You know, Internet Explorer declares itself, but we say Mozilla for some deeply historical reason, and Chrome and Firefox and so forth. You're able to tell who's asking. You know, spiders that crawl the net, they identify themselves as a spider, and so that allows the server to manage them however it wants to. So the point is that similarly, curl will declare something, and maybe there's some way of determining from the metadata, from the query headers, that it's being piped to bash. And he says, a few people have tried this before by checking for the curl user agent, which is by no means fail-safe. The user may simply curl the URL on the command line, revealing your malicious code. Luckily, he writes, the behavior of curl and wget, which is actually that's the tool that I often use on Windows, changes subtly when piped into bash. This allows an attacker to present two different versions of their script depending upon the context. Now, okay, I did last week handle that by suggesting that you curl to a file, browse the file, see what the command stream is, then pipe that file into bash, meaning pipe what you have audited and looked at into the bash command prompt. But anyway, what's clever is, and his point is, that bash is an interpreter that is interpreting line by line what it receives. So if the first line of the script that is coming from the server is a statement like sleep 10, sleep space 10 puts a 10-second pause into the interpretation of the script for whatever reason. Sometimes it's to allow something else to happen asynchronously. You just sort of want to pause the bash script. Maybe you want to put up a notice that the user will see when stuff's crazily scrolling by. You want to just like pause so the user can look at something and then you continue. The point is that will create a pause in the pull from bash through the TCP connection that the remote server could sense. So if the server wanted to be malicious, that is, if it wanted to deliver different content to a terminal window versus bash, it could put a little pause at the beginning. Notice if there was no pause in the pull, then it would say, oh, that sleep statement wasn't interpreted. It was simply displayed by the command window, and that would tell it to follow that with benign content. So the user surveying it would go, oh, yeah, look at that. It looks all fine. Then when they issue the same command but with bash, there would be a pause because bash would interpret the sleep 10 statement, and that would then allow the malicious content to be swapped in its place, and you wouldn't know any wiser. So interesting sort of security lesson there,
I have to say that this kind of piping a script in, you know, downloading and piping, it's done all the time to save people steps and just simplify. I'm looking at, this is something that a lot of people install on their Macintosh. It's called Homebrew. It allows you to install Linux packages, and you can see that the command is a one-liner that curls a script and runs it through Ruby. And that's very common. I mean, you see this all the time.
Well, and again, that's what was so elegant about this was that
it's just simple.
You know, here's like one line, and bang, you've got OpenVPN installed and configured on your Raspberry Pi. That's very cool. But you know, from this podcast standpoint, there is a security implication.
Absolutely. But anytime you install software from an unknown source, especially somebody named Infection.
Infection.
You should be careful. This is OMI Z Shell, which is a really nice shell utility. You see sh-c, and there's a curl command. You curl a script and run it, and it's one-liner, and it just runs it. And so you see this all the time. And if you don't trust these people, they could screw you in many other ways, too. They don't have to run the one-liner.
Right. And again, I think that's... that is an important point, and it's been one of the themes that we've been highlighting recently, which is just how much of the whole system is, in fact, out of our control.
Right.
And we know that security has to be soup to nuts. If you skip a course, you know, there's an opportunity for someone to do a little man in the middle anywhere between the sand coming off the beach to create the silicon for the chips, all the way to you explaining to your mother-in-law why all of her files have been encrypted.
Sorry
about that. What did you click on? Yeah. Okay, so...
Well, it was just a Perl one-liner. I don't understand why.
Okay, so this... I didn't know how I was going to cover this because this was interesting, but the Washington Post covered this event in such a wonderful narrative style that I wanted to just share it as it was written. So this was last week, Thursday evening, 2 weeks after last week's podcast. The writer says, on Thursday evening, a 40-year-old man with dark, curly hair, olive skin, and an exotic foreign accent, and I have a picture of him in the show notes, boarded a plane. It was a regional jet making a short, uneventful hop from Philadelphia to nearby Syracuse. Or so dozens of unsuspecting passengers thought.
Clearly a terrorist. He's using algebra.
Oh. The curly-haired man tried to keep to himself, intently, if inscrutably, scribbling on a notepad he'd brought aboard. A notepad, Leo.
Ooh.
His seatmate, a blonde-haired 30-something woman sporting flip-flops and a red tote bag, who we still don't know her name, by the way.
No, she escaped.
looked him over. She gave him, once over.
Yeah.
He was wearing navy diesel jeans and a red Lacoste sweater, a look he would later describe as simple elegance. But something Something about him didn't seem right to her. So she decided to try out a little small talk. "Is Syracuse home?" she asked. "No," he replied curtly. He simply deflected further questions. He appeared laser-focused. Perhaps too laser-focused, Leo, on the task at hand. Those strange scribblings. Rebuffed, the woman began reading her book. Or pretending to read, anyway. Shortly after boarding had finished, she flagged down a flight attendant and handed that crew member a note of her own. Then the passengers waited and waited and waited for the flight to take off. After they'd sat on the tarmac for about half an hour, the flight attendant approached the female passenger again and asked if she now felt okay to fly or if she was too sick. "I'm okay to fly," the woman responded, but she must not have sounded convincing, though the American Airlines flight 3950 remained grounded. Then, for unknown reasons, the plane turned around and headed back to the gate. The woman was soon escorted off the plane. On the intercom, a crew member announced that there was paperwork to fill out, or fuel to refill, or some other flimsy excuse. The curly-haired passenger could not later recall exactly what it was. The wait continued. Finally, the pilot came by and approached the real culprit behind the delay, that darkly complected foreign man. He was now escorted off the plane too and taken to meet some sort of agent, though he wasn't entirely sure of the agent's affiliation, he would later say. "What do you know about your seatmate?" the agent asked the foreign-sounding man. "Well, she acted a bit funny," he replied, "but she didn't seem visibly ill." Maybe, he thought, they wanted his help in piecing together what was wrong with her. And the big reveal? The woman wasn't really sick at all. Instead, this quick-thinking traveler had seen something, so she had said something. That something she'd seen had been her seatmate's cryptic notes scrawled in a script she didn't recognize. Maybe it was code or some foreign lettering, possibly the details of a plot to destroy the dozens of innocent lives aboard American Airlines Flight 3950. She may have felt it her duty to alert the authorities just to be safe. The curly-haired man was, the agent informed him politely, suspected of terrorism. The curly-haired man laughed. He laughed because those scribbles weren't Arabic or another foreign language. They were some, or even secret terrorist code. They were math. Yes, math. A differential equation, to be exact. Had the crew or security members perhaps quickly Googled this good-natured, bespectacled passenger before waylaying everyone for several hours, they would have learned that Guido Menzio is a young but decorated Ivy League economist, and he's best known for his relatively technical work on search theory, which helped earn him a tenured associate professorship at the University of Pennsylvania, as well as stints at Princeton and Stanford's Hoover Institution. Anyway, yes, see something, say something, but, you know, maybe... who knows what was going on during these hours of tarmac stall and then return to the gate. But no one bothered to figure out who he was. And they do seem to maybe have overreacted a bit, since this was just some math scrawled on a notepad. You know, not formulas for explosives. Wow. The story generated 4,700 comments, which I did not have time or any further need.
I think you get the gist after the first few, I'm sure.
Wow.
Sad that we celebrate ignorance in this country. It really is. It's just sad.
Wow. Okay, now, at first blush, this seemed crazy to me. But upon further digging, I thought, well, there are some applications, perhaps, for this. Gizmodo had the story, and they titled it, "When Your Internet Goes Out, This Smart Plug Resets Your Router Until It Works Again." And I thought, what? So get this. It's a cute little thing, Leo. It's resetplug.com. Bring that up. A big, pretty picture of it. Resetplug.com. Gizmodo wrote, "When your internet goes out, resetting your Wi-Fi router and cable modem often seems to fix the problem. Instead of getting up from the couch to fiddle with power cords, why not let a tiny..."
This is actually a great idea.
Except that it's $60.
I know.
Yeah.
Because the cats knock off our internet all the time, and it would really be...
Why not let a tiny outlet router power cycle your hardware for you? Now they say, they write, "You might balk at the Reset Plug's $60 price tag, but it's not an awful idea for people who hate having to get up when the internet goes out. You plug the device into an outlet, then plug your Wi-Fi router, modem, or both into the Reset Plug itself." It only has one outlet, so you need a Y adapter. "It constantly monitors your home's internet connection. And when it detects a problem, it automatically cycles power to your router and modem until the internet returns." So again, resetplug.com.
I wonder now how much of a delay it puts in there.
There would be some.
It takes a while, right?
Yeah, well, it takes, my God, a cable modem takes about an hour to come back online.
Right.
Now, I was thinking, okay, take that same $60 and just buy a real router. Because frankly, you know.
One that works, you mean?
Yeah, one that doesn't hang. I've never had that happen once. You know, and I buy high-end routers.
Right.
Now I have a little PC running PFSense, and it's just bulletproof.
Right.
But really, come on. You know, yes, you know, you can drive with a tank of gas and jumper cables in your beat-up car that won't hold a charge, or you can just get a good battery. You know, I would just say $60, get a real router, and you're probably fine. However, when I looked at their page, they did bring up some interesting points. Because when you're not home,
right.
You're not there to reset anything.
Right.
And if you're depending upon, as people, as we'll be discussing here when we get to the content of the back half of this, the Internet of Things stuff, then it can and you do have, for whatever reason, a tendency for your home to go off the internet, then this makes a lot of sense. So
I like Lee Hutchinson in Ars Technica wrote about this. He said, "Reset Plug is a $60 device to keep you trapped in crappy Wi-Fi hell." It's a Band-Aid. But it's true that if your burglar alarm is on Wi-Fi, or, you know, my Ring video doorbell and the Wi-Fi's out, the doorbell's not going to work.
Right. Exactly. And so you know, on the Reset Plug page, they say security cameras, thermostats, smart appliances, smoke alarms, carbon monoxide alarms, smart TV or DVR, remote computers, sensor security alarms, smart lighting, file servers, other IoT devices. The point being, yes, I mean, what is actually happening is our homes have to be on the net even when we're not there. Right. For exactly the example you give, Leo, with the Ring doorbell,
right.
But all these other things too. And so, yeah. Now, what we'd like to see is a router that's smart enough to, like, reset itself when it realizes it's lost connectivity. Maybe, I guess if it hangs, though, it can't. But okay, but embedded devices have always had, I'm blanking on the term, a dead man feature where there's a hardware counter, and what it does is it's in hardware, and it counts up, and if it ever overflows, it pulls the hardware reset line. I'm sorry, watchdog timer. That's the term, a watchdog timer, and it's been part of embedded technology forever. So the idea is that in the software loop. That the, you know, the event loop, for example, the main event loop for the software, every so often it has a software timer which expires, and that software timer pulls an interrupt that tells the watchdog, which causes the watchdog timer to be reset. And so the point is, you know, every second or so while the OS is running, it's resetting the watchdog. And if the OS ever hangs for any reason, at the hardware level, that it stops being reset, that hardware counter overflows, and a physical, you know, hardware reset is performed in order to basically reboot the router. It'd be nice if we had that. Apparently we don't in our consumer, you know, blue plastic routers. But anyway, I wanted to share this because, frankly, though it seems a little pricey, you could do this for $20, and I'm sure there will be some for $20. Although, patent pending, because it's an invention, and so maybe not. Maybe you got to go. But still, for I wanted to share it with our listeners because I thought, okay, there will be people for whom this provides an answer that they've been looking for.
Hey, and let me take a break here real quickly, and we'll get back with more. We've got lots more to talk about, including
we do
dumb smart things or smart dumb anyway, something like that. Our show today brought to you by Braintree. Here's something smart to do. If you're a mobile app developer, have a payment system that you don't write yourself that can support every kind of payment. That gives you fast payouts, is easy to use, is just a few lines of code. It's Braintree Payments. And if you need a reference, well, Uber uses it. Lyft uses it. GitHub uses it. Airbnb Hotels Tonight. If you've ever seen those buyable pins from Pinterest, that's Braintree. Maybe there'll be a new way to pay next month or next year, and you would like to include it. Maybe the next Bitcoin or the next Apple Pay or maybe both. Braintree is a full-stack payment platform that easily adapts to the future. In fact, I remember when Android Pay came out, you just open the Braintree control panel, you check the new box that's there that says Android Pay, save it, resubmit your app, you're done. You're done. Accept everything from pounds to PayPal to that next big innovation from any device with one easy integration. No late nights, no complicated rewriting of code. And by the way, because they've been doing this for so long and they know what they're doing, you can be sure about the security. That makes you happy, and it makes your customers happy. They know Braintree. They've been using it too, and it makes them happy, makes them feel safe, and that's what you want. That's one of the reasons Braintree really eliminates this huge problem of abandoned shopping carts on mobile. There's no shopping cart at all when it comes to, say, Uber, right? That's Braintree. So, let me recap. Simple, secure payments, code that you can integrate easily and quickly, Android, iOS, JavaScript, .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, Ruby. You'll like the code. Actually, take a look at the code. Go use the sandbox. Use the sandbox and at braintreepayments.com/security now. And oh, by the way, if you sign up today, your first $50,000 in payments are fee-free. Braintree Payments. .com/security now. Tell the boss. If you're the boss, tell yourself. This is the way to do it. Don't do it yourself. BraintreePayments.com/security now. All right, Steve, onward.
So, catching up on a bunch of loose ends and previous news, The much discussed, oft discussed Temperfect mug.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Arrived.
Yay. Now, that's the titanium edition.
This is the ridiculous, I'm embarrassed now.
Powder-coated titanium.
Spent this much money. Although it'll be interesting to see how it weathers over time. It's a titanium oxide, which, I mean, is just apparently, you can't scratch it. It is, way too hard. It's sputter deposited at 3,500 degrees through some process. And I have to say, I mean, it is gorgeous. It has a sort of a fine grain sandpaper feel, so that, which is nice, because you'd like, if it's not going to be a rubber grip, you'd like it to be a little grippy. And so this provides that. But mostly what intrigued us 3 years ago when this project began on Kickstarter was the concept that, as coffee drinkers, that it had a phase change inner lining, which, and by that I mean it actually is changed from a solid to a liquid, and that changing, it's a waxy like non-toxic substance, which, you know, it's not like exposed to the coffee, it's behind the, it's actually three layers of aluminum, and so there's a sandwich, and the layer closest to the coffee is this stuff, which rapidly, in about 2 minutes, absorbs the initial heat of the coffee, which is initially too hot to drink, bringing it down to drinkable temperature. And so the idea is that inner lining has a large thermal inertia. So it takes the heat out of the coffee, but then puts it back in over time. Yeah, there is this crazy titanium you're showing the video of, it being like sputter deposited.
Yeah,
it's crazy. So the idea is that it pulls the heat out, but then returns it as the coffee cools. And then the next layer is a vacuum layer. And in fact, I mean, these guys, there's been constant email flow from them as they've gone through the trials and tribulations.
Did you get a serial number on yours?
Yes.
You're one of the first 10.
Number 2. There it is.
My God.
You can see him etching it.
Wow.
And so I got a very nice note from Dean, one of the guys. He says, "Hi, Steve. First, the way it looked, I thought it was just printed to all of the early adopters. But he said, 'Hi, Steve. I don't remember exactly how it happened. It's been a long time!' Exclamation point.
They raised $250,000 for this thing.
He says, "But somehow, my nephew, Will LaVallee, brought our Kickstarter campaign to your attention late 2013. You talked about it on your podcast, and I think we got a lot of tech-savvy, coffee-loving backers because of that mention. We really appreciate it. You were also our second Titania mug backer,
wow.
And since we happen to be shipping the Titania mugs first, you get the second ever Temperfect mug. I hope you love it. Feel free to get in touch with any questions or comments." So I just have to say, it's the real deal. The good news is, I think the reasonably priced ones are like $40 or something.
Yeah, that's the one I got, $40. And still haven't received. He said it may take a while.
Yeah, and it actually works. It kept coffee hot for 3 hours. I mean, like truly hot, while the outside was weirdly cold, because, you know, I think the AC was on that day last week. And so it would just, I mean, there was no heat leakage except out of the very top where there's a plastic lid. But for what it's worth, I'm sure all of the backers know, because we were getting constant email from these guys. You know, like all of the problems they had, they are perfectionists, and they were not happy with the way the shutter was working. The first three samples didn't hold vacuum. Then they figured out how to do that. I mean, it was just one thing or another. They didn't give up, and they did deliver. So, you know, bravo. And it's a beautiful piece of work. I mean, it is 100% commercial grade. I have it's got a beautiful seal on the top, and only a you can feel the heat coming through the plastic. So there is some, you know, nominal heat loss, but the bulk of it doesn't lose heat, and it surely does keep the coffee hot for hours. And other people responding to my tweet said, who wants to drink three-hour-old coffee? And that's, you know, you're right. You're normally going to drink it before that, and the point is you can. So there is a very nice solution for keeping our coffee hot for a long time.
Can you still – you can buy them? He's selling them if you didn't get in on the Kickstarter?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They are.
So, yeah, you can.
Okay, so the Healthy Sleep Formula is a hit also. But wasn't effective for everyone. And I think this change will change that. It's something I finally got around to exploring 4 days ago, and it's made a huge difference. And that difference is I switched the L-theanine from a capsule to a tablet. There's a well-regarded company, Source Naturals, which makes effectively a slow release or extended release version of L-theanine, that's the amino acid in green tea, and it is one of the key components of the Healthy Sleep Formula. What it does is raise the level of glycine and GABA, both which are inhibitory neurotransmitters, and also raises dopamine nominally. The problem is that the ability for it to get into our brain through the so-called blood-brain barrier is rate limited. It shares something known as the leucine transport, which is what main dietary amino acids use, and that is a rate limited transport. So what happens is if you take a theanine in a capsule, which when it dissolves, it dumps all of the theanine into your bloodstream, you get a short spike of high concentration, which our livers start metabolizing and rather quickly remove from our blood. One of the things that happens is the greater the concentration, the greater the rate of removal, which creates a half-life effect where the half-life, for example, might be an hour. So an hour after you've taken it, the concentration is reduced in half. And then another hour later, that half is reduced in half. And another hour later, that half is reduced in half. So you get an exponential decay curve. The problem, though, is if our ability to get it into our brain is rate limited, then we've lost the bulk of the effect. Because even though it was initially high concentration, it didn't have a chance to get into us. So of course the melatonin that I chose is similarly time released for the same reason. We want it over the course of the evening. So what this one change by switching to this tabletized form of L-theanine does is it trickles it into our bloodstream over the course of the night. So it raises the level in our blood. Since the concentration level is never super high, our liver's rate of removal of that L-theanine is also not super high. So it gets to stay present, and that's at a compatible level to the rate at which it is able to cross the blood-brain barrier and get into us. Bottom line is this changes everything to such a degree that I'm now having, to rejigger the formula. I tried removing glycine completely last night. That was a mistake. So I had a middle of the night wakefulness for about 90 minutes. But after I realized I wasn't able to get back to sleep, I quickly took some glycine, and as soon as it got into me, then I was. Anyway, there will be more changes coming, but Leo, you, my sister, and my best buddy, who
we've
is,
received the
has
patch.
An,
we have the update, yes. The patch to the formula. Okay,
exactly.
I realize I should take the taurine out. I just reread the page, and you've decided taurine yes. causes you to pee too much. So let's not do that. Okay.
Many people reported that the diuretic effect of taurine was causing them a problem. And while it can be beneficial, it's like, okay, maybe take it in the morning if you're a morning supplement taker. It's good for you. There's lots of benefits to having taurine to supplementing taurine, but not you don't want to take a diuretic just before bed. Taurine's removed, or I should say relocated to the morning. If you might as well use up what you've got. But please, I am amazed at the difference this makes and really delighted, because some people were not finding a success with the formula. And I think this will change that probably across the board. So I've got the links on the Healthy Web on the Healthy Sleep Formula page. I knew that it was going to be subject to change, and I just this is the nature of this sort of work. Other people have had problems, for example, finding GABA. I think Australia, you can't get it, and there are some places in the UK where it is not available. This may obsolete it. I don't know yet. I'll be finding out by challenging myself with some sleepless nights. But so it's still subject to change, but absolutely without question, you want to change to this particular Source Naturals L-theanine. They have some others, but unfortunately, some other L-theanine-containing tablets, but they've also got taurine in them again. And so I think we probably want to stay away from that. Oh, and I've been in constant touch with the Interplexus people that make Seraphos, because, of course, this is the great Seraphos shortage of 2016 that we're apparently is going to end in about 2 weeks. So I did make a note on the page also that by the end of this month, it should be back in stock at retail. They were encapsulating it 2 weeks ago. Now they're running it through quality assurance. And hoping to have it within about a week and a half, and it ought to take some time for it to get out at retail. But many people, there has been no Seraphos in the industry shortly after this healthy sleep formula caused all the retailers to sell out of what they had. And they've been reformulating it. Apparently, we're going to get an even better one next round.
Good.
So the wait is almost over. And I just did want to make – I wanted to make sure that people – who may not have moved on the recommendation last week of the sequence puzzle I wanted to remind people about it. It has been a huge, huge hit. And you said, Leo, before the show, I think, that it was your pick for iOS Today yesterday.
Yep, my app cap. Yep.
It is. Yeah. Do you know how far along you are?
Oh, not very far at all.
Yeah, I'm... Yeah. Many people, there are a couple people in the 40s.
How many total levels are there? Do you know?
I don't know. I don't know. So 22, I was hung up on for a couple days. And I should say, I'm not in a hurry to finish this. I would recommend to people that they just sort of take it as it comes. Look at a level. Spend a few days. What I notice sometimes is that I'll work at it. I can't figure it out. And then I get tired. And it's like, okay, I'm going to put it down. And I pick it up the next day and it comes to me. So anyway, I'm at 29 at this point. I finished 29 and I actually solved it with only three pieces. There were seven available and I only needed three. Which, because I noticed something in an earlier level that was not obvious. So, for what it's worth, people are really liking it. I had also mentioned that someone in the GRC health news group, where there's been a lot of conversation about the Zio EEG headband, was working on and nearly finished with a piece of free open source software that is now at version 1.01. And on the Zio page at GRC, just grc.com/zio.htm, you can find links to that. It's just an amazing amount of additional features beyond the standard Zio software. And we now never need to worry about that Zio software disappearing. This thing is like exports the data, shows much finer grain resolution. If anyone is like deeply into the Zio, then I recommend it. I'm really quite happy with the standard app. It just tells me enough of what I need to know for my own, you know, for the healthy sleep formula research that I'm doing. Second to last is that many people have asked about how I'm cooling the hard drives on this mega machine that I built and talked about a few weeks ago, because I talked about putting some big copper heat sinks directly onto the hard drives. And the problem is that I didn't just buy the heat sinks. I've had them for years. I used to have them on the hard drives in my Series 1 TiVos, just because I believe in keeping drives cool. And so the air circulation in the TiVo would blow across the fins and bring the drive temperature down. What I did do was I put a link in the show notes to the Arctic Alumina thermal adhesive, which I used. This is a two-part epoxy adhesive, and that it is way permanent. So what I did was I peeled the plastic label off of the top of the hard drive so that it's metal on metal, or rather bonded with this thermal adhesive. You want to be careful to see whether there's a vent hole. Many hard drives, if not all, will have a little vent hole somewhere to keep the internal and external pressure equalized. So you don't want to cover that up. But otherwise, if you just eBay or use Amazon or just Google, you know, copper block heat sink fins or something, you get Google's images or just like pictures of them. And all you really want is just a big thing that will fit over the, you know, to occupy a lot of surface area over the drive. And so it doesn't really, I mean, if I just purchased them, I would have a link to offer, but it's really non-critical. You just want to make sure the fins are not too tall so that they'll fit within your enclosure. And there's just tons of copper block heat sinks. So just Google that or look on eBay and get a couple and just glue them to the label removed metal surface of the hard drive, and you should be good to go. And also arrange to have it in the airflow. You want some air to flow over it, and it makes an incredible difference in the drive's temperature. And lastly, many people said, "Hey Steve, don't you know that when you transfer a domain, the recipient registrar always honors the total remaining life of the domain?" And the answer was no, I didn't know that. Now I do. So thank you everyone for telling me. And then I just finished performing a series of experiments, moving some domains that had lots of time left on them over from Network Solutions over to Hover. And Hover wants me to pay for 1 year at that domain's annual fee for moving it over, but then they tack that year onto the existing remaining time the domain had at the old registrar, so that you're not disincentivized from moving to them, which makes sense. I was just surprised because, you know, they're not getting any money for potentially for a long time. So I was That's why I was assuming they weren't going to honor the existing remaining time on the domain, but they do. So for anyone who might also not be sure, I wasn't. Now I am. And everybody else knew. So thank you for letting me know, everybody. And I've confirmed it. And speaking of confirming, not that we need much confirmation at this point of what SpinRite's able to do, but I found a fun story. Actually, he sent it to Sue, who forwarded it to me, from Kev Blythe in the UK. He said, "Hello, Steve. I would like to say thank you for that magical item of software you call SpinRite. A local garage called in a panic." And it's funny, Leo, because you were just talking about some old laptops that are still necessary for car service of some sort.
Oh, yeah. There are 15 McLaren F1s out there, these very, very expensive cars. And the way they created them, I'll see if I can find the image, they can only be modified by a particular old laptop, which they're running out of, because there aren't that many of them.
Yeah, well, so this may, I don't know if that's this or just what the garage had, but he said.
Compact. This is it.
Yep.
That's it. That's the only one they can use.
I have one of those laptops, by the way.
Well, you should contact the McLaren folks.
No, I'm keeping it for the Gibson Museum.
This is probably the most expensive car ever, production car ever produced.
Wow.
Yeah. It's like a $10 million car.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah. They're, wow. They only made 100 of them, and they have to use they only built 106 of them. There are 100 left,
and so it is tied to that some aspect of that particular laptop.
Yeah, because
the software will only run on that laptop.
It's a particular hardware interface.
Oh,
so that's the engine. By the way, it looks like a jet aircraft engine, and the interface is there. You go. You see those big plugs.
It does look like the inside of an airplane.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So but anyway, LTE, so if you've got a compact LTE 5280, I would call McLaren.
Yeah, we'll see what they're willing to pay. So anyway, in this case, he says a local garage called in a panic. An old Diag laptop had failed with a BSOD and was going round and round in circles, like the owner. So I picked it up for a look. I confirmed a hard drive issue. And having worked in a local PC repair shop, where I often witnessed the proof of the power of your software to get hard drives back into bootable state, I headed to GRC for my own copy of SpinRite. I grabbed a copy, and before lunchtime, the machine was repaired, imaged, returned, and smiles all around. Oh. Many thanks, Kev Blythe, UK, and a local garage. So, Kev, thanks for sharing that.
Yeah. Maybe you should. I bet the McLaren folks have a SpinRite line around. Apparently, it's DOS.
I have a lot of the early compact laptops. Yeah. I mean, they weren't really practical back then. Yeah. You know, they were monochrome, but hey, I'm DOS. So,
it's DOS.
It's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Still use Brief. Our show today brought to you by IT Pro TV. I'm telling you, a lot of you I know are IT professionals. And if you remember back to those days when you're studying up for the certs, and maybe you took an expensive course at a school, or maybe you bought those very expensive books, there is now, and you'll be happy to hear it, a better way, a way to keep up on your certs, to get the certs in the first place, to study up, to learn more about your profession. IT Pro TV, created by IT trainers, based on kind of on what we do here at TWIT. They broadcast live 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, East Coast time. They've got two studios, so they're always on. Today, let's see, they were doing querying SQL Server 2014. Tomorrow, OS X Server Essentials, querying SQL Server 2014, Part 2. Installing and configuring Server 2016. Two studios. That's Studio 2. They've also got Studio 1. Let's see what's going on in Studio 1. It's amazing. It's incredible. The amount of content that they produce, you can go to their course library and you'll see they have over 1,000 hours of content on all the areas that you would need to become an IT professional or to stay on top. Apple, Amazon, Cisco, CompTIA, EC Council. Those EC Councils are those certified ethical hacker courses. That's 28 hours taught by Sean Philip Oriano, and you will be prepared for that cert. And what a fun cert to have. If your security is your thing, the ISC Squared certs are great. Microsoft, VMware, Office. Topics include CCNP Security, Certified Cloud Security Professional, Microsoft Server 2016, MCSE, Amazon Web Services, Ethical Hacking, as I mentioned. You can watch them on your laptop, on your tablet. You can use Chromecast because they have apps. You can watch it on the Roku. They got an app for that. Amazon Fire TV, they got an app for that. They have an Apple TV app. You also get with your membership, which is, by the way, monthly or yearly, and it's very affordable, flat rate, so unlimited, all you can eat. You also get the virtual machine labs, which means you can set up and configure Windows servers and clients without Windows, with any HTML5 browser. The Transcender practice exams, they're worth $109 by themselves, so you can take the test before you take the test. Make sure you're prepped. Of course, no hassle cancellation policy because they're geeks like us and they hate it when they bury the cancellation stuff. You get full access with your subscription to show-specific chat rooms. So you can also, just like in our stuff, chat with people who are studying with you. They have Q&A sessions like study groups. Corporate group pricing is available. I want you to check it out. Now, normally, this is the price, and I think it's very fair, $57 a month. By a year, you get 2 months free, $570. But right now, when you go to itpro.tv/securitynow and use the code SN30, you'll get 7 days free and you'll get 30% off forever, which makes it less than $40 a month, less than $400 if you want to get a whole year. That is so awesome. 30% off forever. Again, itpro.tv. Tell your friends, if you know somebody who wants to study and wants to get the certs, wants to get in the business, if you're in the business, you want to get better at it, itpro.tv/securitynow. And that offer code for 30% off and 7 days free, SN30. Great guys doing a great thing, I think. We know so many of you have gotten those certs and gotten into the business, a business we love. All right, Steve. Now, I should tell you, a little disclaimer up front, SmartThings is a sponsor of our network. Okay. They were a Kickstarter product, which I invested in and loved. I bought the original hub. The idea was a single hub and a single app will translate and talk to all the other stuff. And it uses most of the protocols, and it's really convenient. I got the upgraded hub when Samsung bought them like about a year ago, upgraded the hub. And I have all of the devices, so tell me. Am I in trouble?
So, yes.
Oh, dear.
it's a case of the classic trade-off between simplicity and security.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the initial pass being used for more than it was intended to be used for. So, and the good news is there's a future in version 3 of the Zigbee protocol. Zigbee is a low energy, low power, low data rate Wi-Fi. That links all these things together. There's also Z-Wave, and then of course Bluetooth Low Energy are the various technologies. But Zigbee is the one it's been around for more than a decade. It's an IEEE standard 802.15, I think it is dot something or other, and so the. Most of these devices are running on top of Zigbee, and Zigbee is at version 2. I don't know what happened to 2.0 because everyone's already talking about 3. And the problem is that, okay, there are a couple problems. So as I understand it, Samsung purchased SmartThings from the SmartThing guys. I without being a fly on the wall or being privy to their development decisions, I have no context for understanding many of the decisions which an analysis of the result demonstrates were made, which seem wrong in retrospect. So it may be that what's happened is that due to the way the Internet of Things has evolved, we're using this and in a way that is where I'm tempted to say we're misusing it or we're abusing it, which is to say we're relying on a system that was never designed for security, And it was. I was thinking back, for example, to the origin of email, you know, and how we've often talked about how difficult it is to secure email because it was never designed to be secure, you know. And the people who designed it knew that it wasn't secure. It was for academics to send papers and stuff back to each other. And then fast forward 15 years and you're wanting to send, you know, corporate confidential documents to your patent attorney. And it's like, whoa, 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 whoa. It's email's not secure. It's like, well, yeah, but, you know, we want it to be. It doesn't matter. It's not. So probably the SmartThings guys are absolutely aware of the fact that this should not be controlling your door locks. This should not be used for an alarm system. You know, fine, make your lighting green or blue. You know, have it control your light bulbs and, you know, maybe tell you when your toothbrush has been recharged. But don't use this for mission critical things. It's not, we didn't design it for that. Yet, the problem is that wouldn't it be fun if you had, you know, you could use it for your home security. There's a market there. And it's like, yes, but the infrastructure isn't secure. And so you can imagine how it goes from there. So, it is a very cool, open standard, easy to develop for platform that is super popular. It is by far and away the most popular standard that we have at the moment. There's Samsung SmartThings. There's Apple's HomeKit. There's Vera Control has something called Vera 3. Google has their effort, Weave and Brillo. And then there's something called the All Seen. It's a little creepy name. It's at least it's not All Seeing. If it was the All Seeing Alliance, that would be too strange. But it's the All Seen Alliance, which has something called All Join. And they're like the who's who. Basically, everybody else is there. More than 200 members. I put a link in the show notes, Leo, allseenalliance.org/alliance/members. And I mean, the page just scrolls on and on. Canon, Electrolux, LG, Microsoft, Philips, Qualcomm, Sharp, Sony, Buffalo, Asus, AT&T, Cisco, Digicert, Honeywell, IBM, Lighton, Netgear, Panasonic. And those are just the big names. I mean, it's just like, it's again, everybody else. And if numbers matter, that there's a lot there. On the other hand, SmartThings is where like all the action is today. So it's certainly important for us to recognize that we're in early days. And I think where we are is in this awkward place where we're wanting to do things that we don't have the underlying framework for yet. And boy, that's not a new tune. That's the story of the internet, where we decide, oh yeah, let's add forms to the web so users can submit things. And then people say, okay, but that's not secure. Well, but we want it to be. Well, but it's not. Well, but yeah, but we want it to be. Well, okay, sorry. You know. So, several things. Two researchers from the University of Michigan and a researcher at Microsoft Research did a deep dive into the SmartThings system. And they analyzed 499 different SmartThings apps, which are called smart apps, and 132 different device handlers were examined. Without talking to the original developers, without understanding why they made the decisions they did, we can't reverse engineer their intent. But for example, there is a privilege separation model as part of SmartThings, where devices that share the hub are intended to be isolated from each other and separated. Yet the nature of the way this was implemented forces what these guys call significant overprivilege. And I'll define that a little more closely with some examples. But what they found was that more than half, 55% of smart apps are overprivileged due to there being insufficient granularity in the privileges. So again, I don't know why. Maybe they tried to fit all the privileges into a 16-bit token, and so they just lumped them up by category rather than enumerating them for whatever reason. But they also found that once a smart app once installed, a smart app is granted full access to a device, even if the app specifies needing only limited access. So that again makes we want, in order to have a secure system, we want much tighter control. SmartThings has an event based architecture or platform where devices communicate asynchronously. They indicate what events they want to be notified of and then receive that code or receive those notifications. But what the researchers found was that it did not sufficiently protect events which carry sensitive information, such as door lock codes. So I just picked four examples from their work where in exploring this with no documentation or help from the developers, just doing essentially the work anyone could do, they remotely exploited an existing smart app, which is available on the App Store, to program what they called backdoor PIN codes, meaning additional PIN codes, into a connected door lock. Their attack made use of what's called the lock codes capability that the smart app never requested. But the smart app was automatically overprivileged due to the current protocol lacking sufficient granularity. They were able to eavesdrop on the event subsystem within within an installation in order to snoop on the lock pin codes of a Schlage smart lock when the pin codes were being programmed by the user, and then leak them using the unrestricted SmartThings provided SMS API. So essentially they installed a smart app which was a spy, and when the user programmed pin codes, that was SMS'd out to the outside world. And the app that was created simply advertised itself as a battery monitor and only requested battery monitoring capability, yet was able to do much more. They were able to disable an existing vacation mode on the smart app, which was available in the App Store, using a spoofed event to stop the vacation mode simulation. So presumably that like shuts things down or turns something off when you say that you're on vacation, and they were able to defeat that remotely, and no capabilities were required for that attack. And finally, they were able to invoke a fake fire alarm using a spoofed physical device event. And that attack showed that an unprivileged smart app was able to escalate its privileges to control devices it's not authorized to access by misusing the logic of benign smart apps. Then separately, several years ago, because this is, as you noted, was a Kickstarter a long time back, another researcher was able to trivially jam the well-known Zigbee radio frequency used by SmartThings, and was able to enter a protected home.
Anything that used Zigbee would be susceptible to this, right?
True, true.
Not a SmartThings flaw. It's a flaw with any hub that speaks Zigbee.
Well, except that the problem with SmartThings is that there was no acknowledgement given that there was jamming going on.
Oh, I see.
And so you'd like to be able to at least say something is jamming us. You know, there's like a malicious signal in the air. So, but again, I mean, so agreed, Leo, this is a problem with any radio frequency based system which you're using for home security. Which is using sort of consumer grade technology. So this guy was able to, you know, enter tripping window and door alarms and move through the interior, suppressing all warnings. And the system didn't acknowledge that there was a problem.
Wow.
So, yeah. So, and I don't want to mischaracterize this final piece. So I'm going to share what Dan Lieberman, who is the head of research and standards at SmartThings, said just this last December, because there's something known in the protocol that they're built on this Zigbee protocol. And again, it's not their fault that they're using Zigbee, except that Zigbee's what everyone uses. And so my point is that it's not ready for prime time. It's an insecure system. So he explains in his FAQ at SmartThings. He says there are really two distinct things at play here, and I'll do my best to describe them, what their potential impacts are, and what we're doing at SmartThings to eliminate or mitigate them. I apologize in advance if this is overly dense, but there's a lot to get to here, and of course it won't be dense for our audience. He says, what are the issues? First, as has been pointed out in this thread, there is a designed moment of insecurity in the Zigbee Home Automation 1.2 spec that uses a well-known symmetric encryption key known as the Trust Center Link Key to distribute a unique network key when a device first joins the network. Okay, now I should pause here and say that it's much worse than that. It is possible, but since this Trust Center link key is globally known. It's been tweeted. Anyone with a Zigbee radio and an Arduino can become a device on anyone else's SmartThings network. That is, it is trivial to authenticate yourself, unfortunately, to the network. And the reason is that they want to make it easy. And it is. Unfortunately, it's easy to abuse. Anyway, he continues saying, this is a trade-off that the Zigbee Alliance chose to make between security and simplicity, with a mitigated impact given that an attacker would have to be capturing Zigbee network traffic at the same time that a new device is being joined to the network. And that actually is not true. Many people, there's a lot of demonstration of researchers who have just added themselves to existing networks. He says this method, and this is the key though, the good news is this method has been removed from the upcoming Zigbee 3.0 specification and replaced with a process that requires a per-device installation code that is used to generate a unique joining key, which is then used to acquire the Zigbee network key. The install code may be printed on the device, may be a 2D barcode that is scanned by a camera, or some other out-of-band method of passing the code from the end device to the Zigbee coordinator device. In our case, the SmartThings hub, such as NFC or Bluetooth Smart. Okay, so again, where we are is, it's as he says, the acknowledged trade-off between security and simplicity. And the problem is we're in this place at the moment where an insecure technology that its designers probably never intended to be used for secure applications is nevertheless being used for security applications. And it won't, but work is underway for the spec to catch up. The problem is none of the existing devices will be 3.0 Zigbee. It'll only be things after the Zigbee 3.0 spec happens, which understand this secure protocol join technology. And they won't be as easy to join, but they shouldn't be, because the fact that it's so easy means that attackers can do it too. And so, you know, nothing new here for our audience. He says the second issue described by the CognoSec, there was a report that I've linked to at the bottom, which is an extensive reverse engineering analysis, which is different than the research that I talked about before, the U of Michigan guys and the Microsoft research researcher, is a method known as insecure rejoin. Insecure rejoin also exists in the Zigbee Home Automation 1.2 specification as a trade-off between security and simplicity. This method allows a previously paired device to rejoin a network using the same well-known Trust Center link key in the event that the network key changed since the last time the device joined the network. This enables battery-powered devices that aren't always listening for commands from the Zigbee coordinator, otherwise known as sleepy devices, to rejoin a network if the network key changed. As the sleeping device wouldn't have received the new key update from the Zigbee coordinator. So if an end device, such as a motion sensor or contact sensor, fails to join the network using their stored key, they can ask for the new key, which is transmitted using the well-known Trust Center link key. Well, okay, wide open security breach. because it means that anything can pretend to be an, I don't know, the network key. Please send me the network key using the Trust Center link key, which is public knowledge. So anyway, he says the specific issue that Cognosec describes in their publication is the ability to spoof a device on the network to send a false, insecure rejoin request, triggering the network key to be sent using the well-known Trust Center link key. This bypasses the mitigation effect described above, which, as I already said, isn't valid. I mean, isn't a mitigation even. As an attacker could, he says, potentially cause, well, yeah, I would say readily cause, the network key to be transmitted at will. So then he says, how is SmartThings impacted and what are we doing about it? SmartThings currently supports insecure rejoin, as many Zigbee home automation devices will only attempt to rejoin once with their stored key before reverting to an insecure rejoin mode, meaning that the SmartThings hub and architecture has had to come down to the lowest common denominator in order to be to be functional with the least secure of any of the Zigbee home automation devices. This means, he says, that without secure rejoin, if there are any issues rejoining the network after a hub reboots or a router in the mesh goes away, the device would not be able to rejoin the network and would be effectively stranded. The only way to resolve a stranded device would be to delete it from SmartThings, perform a factory reset on the device, and put it back through the initial join process. We do recognize the security concerns presented by spoofed insecure rejoin requests. And since the issue was brought to our attention, we've been developing an update that will give users the option of turning off insecure rejoin while we work to understand the broader negative impact of simply disabling it by default. We hope to have this update in place within the next 60 days. Well, that was written in December, and it's not in place today, so it's taking longer than they had hoped. Once the feature is available, we'll let you know how to go about disabling insecure rejoin. In the longer term, the Zigbee 3.0 specification eliminates the insecure rejoin process. And again, I'll say the problem being that none of the existing devices will know about 3.0, and they will all assume insecure rejoin is available. So I don't know how that's going to get handled. As for the initial joining process, SmartThings must support the standard Zigbee Home Automation 1.2 Trust Center link key join process, because that's how nearly all Zigbee Home Automation 1.2 certified devices join a Zigbee network. Again, lowest common denominator problem. And as an open platform, we support many Zigbee Home Automation certified devices from many manufacturers. As mentioned above, Zigbee 3.0 will eliminate the moment of insecurity, but we're also exploring methods, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, so you get the picture. So I don't mean to beat up on them. This is the dilemma of a system where user convenience completely trumps security. And if it was light bulbs, you know, and your TV, I mean, you know, things where security didn't matter, fine. Unfortunately, it's because of the convenience and people saying, oh, hey, let's do, you know, home security. Well, as long as you regard it as a toy, it's fine. Don't expect it to protect you, or at least, I mean, in the default case, it probably can, but it is not robust in by any means in the face of anyone who wants to defeat it. At this point, it's just a wide open system. And again, not SmartThings' fault. It's the fact that that they're trying to be compatible with in order to say they are Zigbee home automation compatible, they've had to accept the operation of things that are just not secure. And unfortunately, it's brought the whole system down to that level. So again, we're in the early days. And I would simply urge people to wait until we have a standard defined. If you really want security, just don't rely on this for, you know, any application where you're relying on it for affirmative, you know, serious residential security. Use it for things that are fun. And also consider that you're probably going to have to replace a lot of your early hardware once a secure spec occurs. The good news is it is being worked on and the problems are recognized. And ultimately, it'll be less easy to use, but it needs to be less easy to use. There has to be an out of band process. And we've talked about this often. I mean, it's why authentication is a problem. It's why, you know, why Signal and WhatsApp and Threema show you an optical instance of an identity because you need out of band authentication. There's no way around that. Otherwise, anybody can pretend to be a valid device and get into your network. So I think this is going to advance over time. It's early days. I would consider this a toy at this point, not something you use for mission critical work. But I think we're going to get there.
Good. Would this be, but now just to be fair to SmartThings, this would be a problem with any hub that uses Zigbee, right?
Yes, any, yeah, exactly. It's
I
not
think
about SmartThings
is getting the attention because they're responding to it. I think most other Zigbee is a widely used protocol. So what we're really saying is don't use Zigbee for home security.
Yes.
SmartThings
yes.
does support and, other protocols like Z-Wave, so I'm not sure. I imagine somebody's looking at Z-Wave as well, which is a similar protocol.
Yeah.
It sounds like these shouldn't be used for home security because radio jamming would be an issue.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
There are like 500 SmartThings app and 50 other things
right.
apps. I
right.
mean, they're like or
they're the king of the hill.
SmartThings
no,
is the absolute
yeah.
leader.
Right.
And
right.
so, of course, they're the people that the people do. You know,
yeah. I just want to be fair to them. It's not something they did. It's a
agreed.
Flaw in a protocol they support.
And, although earlier I was talking about what, you know, things that are hard to explain, the overprivilege of devices, the fact that unprivileged devices are able to do things, that's different than the Zigbee level. That is about the SmartThings protocol.
Right.
You know, and it's not fair. They're not here to defend themselves. So as I said, I don't mean to attack them. There's no context for understanding what the security researchers found and were able to do. And if someone sends me a link, I would certainly happily cover that in the future.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Once again, Steve Gibson. He is our support, our staff, our candle in the wind.
Are now exhausted.
And he's sleeping well. He didn't sleep well last night, but he's going to sleep well tomorrow.
Actually, I got 8 hours because I gave myself a buffer knowing that I might lose an hour and a half in the middle.
Yeah.
So I did get eight.
The rest of us call it sleeping in. He calls himself, I gave myself a buffer. That's Steve right there in a nutshell. I sleep in. He gives himself a buffer. Steve, if you want to know more about the Healthy Sleep Formula, the latest, grc.com. There's lots of free stuff, lots of interesting information. We should say Steve's not a doctor. He's just an interested amateur and, you know, take it with a grain of salt.
Whatever. And you know what I was realizing, too, is that, you know, the constant theme here is technology.
Yeah.
And I think of technology as applied science. So it's, you know, science is sort of the theory and an understanding of what happens. Technology is taking that and making it do something.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm for the last 10 years, I've been learning about the science of our biology. And so in the same way, I'm into what intrigues me is the technology. Is like, okay, why does 200 milligrams of the same amino acid dribbled out over time have a phenomenally more powerful effect than that 200 milligrams released at once? And I understand it. And, half an hour ago, I explained it. And to me, that's just fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And, Leo, wait till you try this. It is night and day.
He's hacking his sleep.
It changes everything.
I can't wait. you should also check out SpinRite. That's there, too, grc.com. That's the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility. And also text transcripts of the podcast are at the website, grc.com. So are, of course, the podcasts themselves, the audio versions of the podcast. And if you have a question for Steve, you can leave a question there, grc.com/feedback. He also accepts the occasional DM. Well, accepts them all. I don't know if he reads them all. At SGGRC on the Twitter. We have full quality audio and video on our website, twit.tv/SN. Doesn't matter where you get it. Either way, just fine with me. Or subscribe, because it is a podcast. That means there's an RSS feed, and you can plug that into your favorite podcatcher, and you should get it. Or use the Twit apps. They're everywhere, and subscribe that way. But we do this show every Tuesday, 1:30 p.m. Pacific, 4:30 p.m. Eastern, 20:30 UTC. If you want to stop by and watch live, you can also do that. Make sure you're here next Tuesday and every Tuesday for Security Now. See you, Steve.
Thanks, Leo. Security Now.